You are listening to a podcast produced and distributed by ChristHoldFast.com. Please visit ChristHoldFast.com for additional resources. This is 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. Welcome back to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. This is episode 19, I believe. I am Daniel Emery Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird, as usual. Brandon is unavailable as of right now. He might end up jumping in at some point. So we'll see. He might just randomly show up through the recording of the show. Chad, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. I'm thinking Brandon probably went out for coffee. And he's going to be coming back shortly. So he'll be primed and ready by the time he joins us halfway through the program.
That alarm went off and he's like, I'm out of coffee. I can't do it. He's headed to the store right now.
Probably so. But that's fine. We'll get started and he can add his insights a little bit later on. I think we're in chapter 13 of Genesis. Is that right?
I think you're right.
All right, very good. Well, if you've been following along, you know that last time we wrapped up that second half of chapter 12. Chapter 12 ends with that scandalous story of Abraham and Sarah going down into Egypt and getting into trouble with Pharaoh and Sarah being taken into Pharaoh's house and God plaguing Pharaoh's house and Pharaoh finding out this whole messy situation of Abraham lying about Sarah being his sister, and the ensuing affair that takes place unbeknownst to Pharaoh. He's sleeping with Abraham's wife. Well, anyway, as we talked about in that last episode, we see that Abraham was a sinner just like all of us. He resorted to selfish behavior, and God was intervening to save the situation from becoming any worse. And he brings Abraham and Sarah out of Egypt, and he's sending them back into the promised land. And that's where we pick up here with chapter 13. And it's kind of I like to look at these stories with a bigger picture in mind too, because what you have happening with Abraham and Sarah is sort of like a mini Exodus. I think we talked about that last time, how what happens to Abraham is a foreshadowing what's going to happen to his descendants, because Abraham goes down into Egypt because of a famine. He gets into trouble with Pharaoh while he's there, and then God brings Abraham out of Egypt. And that's the same thing that happens in broad strokes anyway with the whole nation of Israel. They end up in Egypt because of a famine. While they're in Egypt, they get into trouble with Pharaoh, and God ends up bringing them out in what we think of as the Exodus. It's actually a Exodus, because there were all sorts of exoduses that took place in the Old Testament. So you have Abraham, as it were, blazing the trail for his descendants to come. He is acting out beforehand what his descendants will experience in the major Exodus that takes place when they leave Egypt. And also interestingly, and that's why I bring it up here, you have kind of the follow-up to that story in Abraham's life, patterning once more what's going to happen in the case of the nation of Israel. Because when Abraham and Sarah go back to the Holy Land, what God does is he sends him throughout the land of Canaan to mark it as his own. He's to go north and south and east and west and walk through this whole land to claim ownership of it. And that's the same thing that's going to happen with his descendants. When they leave Egypt in the Exodus, they're going to eventually work their way back to the promised land. And under the leadership of Joshua, they will go north and south and east and west, and they will tread upon this holy soil and they will claim it as their own. So you can kind of see happening in Genesis what you see happening actually a lot of times, where you see these patterns beginning to emerge, or the sometimes called types beginning to emerge, that are brought out more fully later on. So we have this foreshadowing, this preview happening in Abraham's life of what's going to happen in the life of his descendants. And of course, this finds its fulfillment in the New Testament, because we have the ultimate exodus happening in the life of the Messiah, in which all of these former exoduses come to their culmination on the Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus is talking with Moses and Elijah. We know what their conversation was about. They were talking about the upcoming exodus that was going to take place with Christ in Jerusalem. That exodus is his giving of his life as the Passover lamb, his leading of us out of the darkness of our own Egyptian land of sin and death, and finally into the promised land of grace and forgiveness. So all of these exiles and returns that you see happening in the Old Testament, in Abraham's life and the life of Israel, these finally come to their apex in the saving work of Christ and his exodus on our behalf. So they're all pointing forward to what's to come. So that's kind of the big picture of what's going on here in 12 and 13. So I guess we'll take a step back and look at a few details here in chapter 13, and we might even get into a discussion of chapter 14, which is all about Melchizedek. It's interesting to me that at the beginning of chapter 13, verse 2, after Abraham comes out of Egypt, it says that he was very rich in livestock and in silver and in gold. And this is sort of a parenthetical comment, but I think it's one worth making. Dan, you read the parable of Lazarus and the rich man in the Gospels, and of course the parable is about this rich man who's not named, and how he basically ignores Lazarus, who's at his gate, and he's a beggar. He's covered with sores. The dogs come up and lick his sores. They're his only real companions. And then Lazarus dies, and the rich man dies, and the rich man is in torment, and Lazarus is with his Lord. But I've always found it interesting that the description that's given of where Lazarus is at is that he's in the bosom of Abraham.
Yeah.
And I don't know if folks have thought of that, because it's easy to read that parable as what? It's just kind of a lesson about the difference between rich and poor people, right? Kind of a simplistic reading of that, as if being rich is an evil in and of itself. And
Yeah.
yet, where does Lazarus end up? He ends up in the bosom of Abraham. So he ends up in the bosom of the patriarch, who is described in several places in Genesis as a very rich man.
Yeah.
So it's not as if the acquisition of riches and the holding of riches, being rich, is not a sin. It's not evil. The evil of the rich man in that parable was not that he was wealthy. What his problem was his own. He was his own god, and his riches had become his god. That's what he loved, and that's what he trusted, and that's what he feared losing more than anything else. That's the point. One of the points of the parable. When Paul talks about money, he says that not. He doesn't say money is the root of all evil. He says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil.
It is true. There's ditches on either side of all kinds of this stuff, but obviously we know those guys that take some Old Testament stories where, and there's a lot of them, where God gives someone a lot of stuff. Abraham's not the only person in the Bible that God gives a bunch of wealth to. He gives the spoils of his enemies to. He does this a lot of times. And he prospers people all over the Old Testament. Now we know those guys that then take that and say, that's a promise. That's where things get weird. Where when you say, well, God gave Abraham all this stuff, and God gave whoever all this stuff, therefore, he's going to give you all this stuff. It's like, well, that's not a 1 and 1 equals 2 equation there. That's not a promise to me, but that is something that he did to Abraham. And so you have that ditch, and people fall into it all the time. So God's main objective is to get you stuff. That's what he's all about. If you don't have a bunch of stuff, then you're somehow not in the will of God, obviously. But if you were like Abraham or whoever these other people were, well, dang it, you would have all this stuff too. So your goal in life becomes getting aligned with the will of God to get the stuff. And the devil is more than happy to have that be your goal. On the other side of that, and I think maybe largely because that ditch exists, you have the other ditch that says all this stuff is bad. Like, if you got stuff, if God does give you stuff, well, you're probably outside the will of God. You probably love riches. You probably worship money, and you're probably terrible. That's a different ditch altogether, because that stuff's not bad if God chooses to give it to you. So yeah, I think that we're able to go off the road either direction with this kind of stuff, and do all the time. People go off here, and you can actually you can idolize poverty if you want. You can think that somehow being in lack somehow makes you more holy. People do that all the time. Somehow if you're living in a grass hut, or you've got nothing, somehow that's more pious than having a whole bunch of stuff. And neither one of those things are true. If the rich man looks down on the poor man and thinks that somehow he's more blessed and more pious, well, he's in sin. And if the poor man looks at the rich man and says, well, I'm more humble before God than you are because you have all this stuff, well, that's sin. And so both are wrong.
Yeah. I was, when you were talking, I was thinking it basically boils down to either side of the ditch that people fall in. It's because of a wrong idea of righteousness. You know, on the one hand, there's the moralizers who say that, well, if you were more like Abraham, if you were in the will of God like Abraham, then you would be rich like Abraham. So that's saying that if I'm righteous enough, then God is going to bless me like this. And then you have the other side, which is just another kind of false righteousness, which says that, well, if I'm humble enough before God in the poverty that I experience, then God is going to bless me. So either way, you end up with this idea that it's what I do or what I deprive myself of that merits the blessings of God.
Yeah, yeah.
And both ignore the fact that these are gifts, plain and simple. They're not earned. And the lack of them is not something that is a punishment. It's just, these are gifts. And God gives more to some and less than others materially. But we can make an idol out of anything. I mean, that's where humanity is most creative. Our highest creativity as humans is in our ability to almost from anything to make an idol. I mean, it can be, I think Luther says in the Large Catechism that Mammon is the most common idol on earth, and I don't disagree with that. But we can make an idol out of just anything. Anything we fear, love, or trust in God above all things, whether that's money or the lack thereof, our riches or our poverty, or our family, the church, our career, I mean, you name it, whatever it is, we can carve and engrave it into this idol that we bow down before. And we all have them.
Yeah,
we all have them.
It's easy to make an idol out of something. So you got a bunch of money. It's easy to make that your idol. It takes a special skill to make an idol out of nothing.
Yes, yes.
I've got nothing, therefore God is pleased with me.
Right,
It's like that's how bad man is. Like, did you just worship nothing? I think you just worship nothing. How did you?
Yeah, see, that's why we're so good at what we do. We are ever since Eden, we have been excellent idol makers. That is the gift that every person has. Some people are gifted in some ways and not in others, but we all share that one common gift. We are excellent idol creators. So that was kind of an aside, but I think it's worth pointing out here that Abraham was very rich, and that's where Lazarus ended up, in the bosom of Abraham. So then you got back in Genesis 13, you got this real interesting story about a family dispute that occurs between Abraham and his nephew Lot. You remember that when Abraham left his father's house and his father's land and went where God was pointing him to go, even though he didn't know exactly where he was going, that he took with him his nephew Lot, because his brother had passed away, and so he took Lot under his wing to be his protector, his foster father, you might say. And both of them ended up with quite a bit of possessions. So much so that they had so much livestock that you have this strife that begins to occur between these two groups, between the servants of Lot and the servants of Abraham, because they didn't have enough land. They didn't have enough space for their respective herds. And so it's interesting to me, Abraham's approach here. And I was thinking about this morning, looking at this story, how Abraham seems to bounce back and forth between, I mean, he's in Egypt, and we've talked about what he did down there, his reactions to his fear, and all the problems that came about as a result of that. But if you look at Abraham here, he's making a very humble and wise decision, because when this strife develops between him and Lot, I'm looking here at verse 8. Abraham takes the initiative. He says to Lot, he says, "Let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers." And he says, "Is not the whole land before you? So please separate from me. If you go to the left, then I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, then I'll go to the left." So what Abraham is doing is he's basically just saying to Lot, "Hey, you have your pick of the land. We got this whole land before us. You choose the place that you want to be." And where does Lot choose? This also is rather fascinating. Lot looks up and he sees all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. And then we have this parenthetical comment that this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And this whole valley of the Jordan, it says, was like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. And that's where Lot ended up choosing for his place. Now it's interesting to me, this how Lot is so much like the typical person, because he looks out over the land, and where does he choose? What kind of place does he choose? It's the best, right? That's where at least it looks the best, right? It's
That
this
would make
lush
sense.
land. And what's that?
That would make sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Right. That's where he wants to be. He wants to be in the place where you have the best, I guess, best grass for his livestock. He thinks it's going to be the choice place to be. And yet, as we know, as the story unfolds, this particular place ends up being what seemed to have the greatest blessing, ended up being the very place that was later on to be destroyed. So it's the beginning of all sorts of problems for Lot, and we see the start of this already in the next chapter, because it's when he settles here, he's going to get attacked and kidnapped. And then, of course, later on, we have the whole story of the Lord's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And I guess if there's anything that I see here, it's that appearances are deceptive, and that very often we're deceived by that, because we expect to be able to see with our eyes and to understand with our mind where the Lord's blessings are located, and it doesn't always work that way. We have this built-in tendency to think that we are able to look out over a family or a church or a nation or an individual or whatever it is, and be able to discern by mere observation where the Lord has placed his greatest blessings, and likewise where he's placed his greatest curses. But that's not the way the Lord works. Our eyes are two liars, and they lie to us. They lie to us constantly. If there's anything that the scriptures show over and over through all sorts of narratives, it's that you cannot look at a person's life and discern on the basis of that their status before God. You look at a person, and maybe they're in a seemingly great marriage, and they're doing well for themselves, and they always seem happy. They have the best of everything, and our tendency is to think that that person must be in some kind of good favor with God, because they enjoy so many material blessings. And then on the opposite side of that, we see someone who is lonely or sick or deprived of a lot of worldly blessings, and maybe they have all sorts of struggles in life over whether it's health or relationships or whatever it might be, and we think, oh well, it appears as if that person has been deprived of the blessings of God. And yet appearances are deceptive, because there's no way that we can simply look at what is happening and be able to discern on the basis of that alone, on these externals, exactly how God is active in that person's life.
Yeah, Job is an excellent example of that. There's I can't remember which chapter it is offhand, but one of the chapters of Job, one of the arguments that one of his good friends that he calls miserable comforters, one of the arguments that they make is, well, clearly, you are not in a good place with God. Clearly, you are hiding all this sin. I mean, it's obviously, look at you. And one of the things that they actually say is, don't you know that the wicked don't prosper? And you're not prospering right now. And Job's response is awesome, because I'm going to paraphrase, but this is basically Job's response. He like basically calls bullcrap on that whole thing, and just says, "What are you talking about? Look, take a look around. Wicked people be prospering all over the place. Everywhere I look, there's wicked people prospering, man. Like, what are you nuts?" And then he tells them, "This is great. Like, you got to be really confident in your blamelessness to make this kind of assertion." But he turns around and says, "Look, man, like, you know me. I'm a stand-up dude. If this is happening to me because of what I've done, you're in big trouble."
Yeah, because
Because
look at yourself, right?
everybody knows, everyone standing here knows, I'm way better than you.
Let's compare moral pedigrees here.
Yeah.
I can stand up with any of you guys. And yet, look what's happened to me.
Yeah. You better hope that that's not true, man. Like, but no, but that's what he does. He totally says, no, man, I reject that on its face. Like, look around. There's wicked people prospering all over the place. Like, this is not a good gauge. You can't, like, come up here and say, well, things are going bad for you. Therefore, you and God are not good.
Yeah, I mean, we fall into the same thing ourselves. You know, I was talking about how we look at other people, and I think we can discern on the basis of that alone how God is blessing or not blessing them. But I mean, it's the same with us, right? I guarantee you that if I drove to work in a little bit and my boss called me to the office and told me I was fired, and then I went back out to drive back to my house and I had a couple flat tires, and then when I finally got back to the house, it had burned to the ground, and I called my wife and she got fired today. If all of this happened, I guarantee you that the thoughts running through my head would be, oh my God, what did I do to make God so angry? I know myself, because I've never experienced anything quite all those bad things in such rapid succession, but I have had plenty of occasions where things go wrong, and the first thought in my head is, oh my God, what did I do?
Yeah.
You know, I have pissed off God in some way. And this is the punishment that I'm reserved. That's just, that is so ingrained in us. And then the opposites happen too. You know, some good things will start happening. And the next thing I know, running through my head is, man, God must be happy with me because all these great things are happening right now.
Yeah. I had a real life example of this happening to me. Like, when I was going through like the worst period of my whole life, and it was my own fault. I had lots of bad things happening, but I knew it, and I was repentant and all this stuff, but I was, you know, I was suffering, and I played basketball like my whole life, and kept playing basketball out of high school and all that, played a couple times a week, and so I was in the midst of all this, and I was going to play basketball, and that was sort of my like my escape from all this stuff that was going on in my life. And I go to the gym, and I'm playing basketball, and I broke 4 bones in my hand.
Ouch.
Okay. And my initial thought, like, and I knew it had happened.
First thing that comes to mind, right?
When you break 4 bones in your hand, you know that you have done something, that something bad has happened. And I knew that, like, I was not going to be able to, I hadn't even been to the doctor yet, but I knew, I was like, I could tell by what it had just happened that I wasn't going to be playing basketball for quite some time. And I audibly said, like, come on, God. Like, seriously? Like, what? Like,
why did you just do this to me?
What?
Right?
I mean, dude, on top of everything else, like, I got to get, like, physically crushed here? Like, what is going on? Like, man, you are angry with me.
Man, I've been there. And I guarantee you, everybody listening to this right now, if they're honest with themselves anyway, they've been there too. That's like that is the gut reaction. Whether what happens is bad or what happens is good, is that we interpret what happens to us on the basis of our righteousness. That's what happens. That we interpret what happened. That is kind of our hermeneutic, our interpretive lens through which we try and understand the reality around us. If things are going great, it's because God's happy with me. If things are going bad, it's because God's mad at me. So that's the way we approach life.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, and even Job, like in Job, like buys into this a little bit by the end, and he's like, does the same thing. I mean, he does over and over again. He is doing the come on, like what? Come on, God, like what is this? Like this is like what? What's going on, you know? And God's response is awesome to him, which is, well, first he says, dress for action like a man. Like, so like, that's a good line. So like, you're gonna make an accusation about me, about what's going on with you. Like, all right, like, you know, stand up, let's do it. And
let's do this.
And then, like, yeah, and then his response is like, you know, where essentially it's this, like, all right, cool, where were you when I made the ostrich? Were you not around? You ever seen an ostrich? Did you come up with that? Oh, you didn't? Okay, well, why don't you just like trust that I know what I'm doing?
Yeah, talk about a reality check. Job is the classic example of that, and we're all there almost on a daily basis, in fact, but especially when the really bad stuff happens or the really good things happen. That's the way we think. And that's probably, you know, when Lot chose the place that he chose, this Garden of Eden like area of the land of Canaan, he probably thought, man, this is good, God's going to be good to me. I've got everything together here, and I've chosen the perfect spot, and too bad for Uncle Abraham, but he's going to have to settle for the leftovers. So that's what happens next. And then we have this section here at the end of chapter 13, which I think is fascinating in its own right. I wrote an article this past, I believe it was this past week, about this section at the end of chapter 13, and for the website 1517 Legacy, just reflected a little bit on what happens to Abraham after he separates from Lot, because you have this very interesting command from God. So beginning of verse 14, God says to Abraham, after they had separated, after Lot and he had separated, to lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever. And then he goes on that I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. And then this is verse 17. This is for me, the most fascinating verse. He says, arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, and I will give it to you. Now, the reason this is interesting to me is because some research I was doing on exactly what this meant and why Abraham had to walk all over this land. It turns out that it was pretty commonplace in the ancient world that if you owned land, or if you were going to take possession of that land, that you had this symbolic acquisition of the land by walking on it. So if I was going to buy a section of land, then one of the things that I needed, I didn't just kind of sign a paper, you know, this bill of sale. I would literally walk over it. And as I was walking on this land, that was me enacting my ownership of it. I was placing the soles of my feet upon the land that was now going to be mine. And we have an echo of this in the book of Ruth. It's a section that I never really understood until I looked into this a little bit more. But when Boaz acquires some land, he's getting Ruth, and he's getting some land also. It this is in chapter 4 of Ruth. It says that it was the custom at that time that when land was exchanged, that the man who was selling the land would remove his sandal and give it to the guy that was buying the land. Now, the reason that this took place, that always seemed to me, you know, weird. What's up with this shoe exchange going on? But that's the background of this. The previous owner had used these sandals to walk over the land, and so the sandals had become the symbol of the land. And so when he handed the shoe over to the new owner, he was handing over the land to the new owner. That's why you had this exchange going on. So what Abraham is doing back in Genesis is that he is claiming ownership of the Holy Land. He's walking over it in order that he might impress his name upon it. This is God's gift to me and to my descendants. And I think it's interesting too, if you look at this in the kind of the broader perspective of the Bible, because I suspect that's part of the reason behind why the feet of those who bring good news are called beautiful. Isaiah talks about how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news, who announce peace, who say to Zion that your God reigns. Isaiah says that, and then Paul quotes that in his letter to the Romans. The reason that the feet of God's messengers are beautiful, one of the reasons anyway, is because where those feet go, where those feet are treading, God is establishing the kingdom of God. So where those feet go, where the messenger is proclaiming the king, he's also claiming this place for the kingdom of God. And so the beautiful feet of the messengers are beautiful because here is where God is staking his claim. He's saying, this place is mine. These people are mine. Here I am proclaiming peace. Here I am proclaiming my kingdom. And I think we see the background of that here in what Abraham is doing in the Promised Land. I think it fills in some of the gaps there in our understanding of why the land, why the Holy Land is as important as it is. All right, so that puts us to the end of chapter 13, and where we end up here is in verse 18. Abraham moves his tent, and he dwells by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he builds once more an altar to the Lord. I think this is the third place that he'd built an altar so far. And that's where we're, I think it'd probably be a good spot to stop. We're not quite at 40 minutes, but before we jump here into chapter 14, that's probably a good place to leave off.
Well, that's a rare thing for us to end right beforehand. We don't usually. Maybe if we do that a few times, if you take the entirety of 40 minutes of the Old Testament, divide it by the number of episodes, it will average out to 40.
Yeah, maybe so.
That's what we've really been.
I was counting on Brandon to join us halfway with the coffee and add some further insights, but I guess he's didn't make it.
So what's going to happen in the very next chapter? You can at least tell us. You give us the what is,
yeah,
coming next.
What's, let's give a yeah, let's give a little teaser here. Chapter 14 is one of the most interesting and mysterious chapters in all of Genesis, because we have this guy by the name of Melchizedek, which seemingly appears out of nowhere, is there with Abraham for just a short period of time, long enough to give him some bread and wine, to bless him, and to receive a tithe from Abraham. And then he vanishes from sight. He disappears from the story, only to reappear in Psalm 110, the psalm that is one of the most messianic of psalms that we have. And then, lo and behold, we get to the New Testament, and once more Melchizedek comes up as one of the central parts of the argument in the book of Hebrews as to who Christ is and his superiority to the Levitical priesthood of old. So it's going to be a lot of fun talking about Melchizedek and how he grew from being this, four verse person in Genesis 14 to being this huge part of the argument about how Christ is the great priest, our high priest, in the book of Hebrews.
All
so,
right.
Join us in.
I love me some Melchizedek, so I'm looking forward to it. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining us again. And go over to the website, and you can get back episodes there. You can read articles there. You can listen to the other podcasts there. And definitely go over to iTunes, rate and review, subscribe, tweet this stuff out, Facebook this stuff out, tell your friends, try to get as many people as you can listening to this if you think it's beneficial. So we will see you guys next week.